Welcome to True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to a Rewind episode. What are Rewind episodes, you may ask? Well, they're really just a way to revisit older episodes that you may have missed. True Crime South Africa has more than 200 episodes right now. And although many of you may have listened to each and every one twice, many episodes seem to have been lost in the wave of new content. New episodes take a ton of research time, and I can't always balance a brand new one every single week with all the other stuff. So occasionally I'll be encouraging a review of True Crime South Africa's back catalogue with these Rewind episodes. But it's not just the same episode repeated. In many cases, I'll include a bit of a tack on at the end with updates on new information I've found or received since the release of that episode. I often get comments about how people going back to my earlier episodes find it so interesting to hear how much my delivery on the podcast has changed. And through doing these Rewind episodes, I can definitely hear it too. In most Rewind episodes, you'll be hearing both 2025 Nicole and 2020 Nicole, for instance, in the same episode, which may be a little jarring, but it's also kind of cool. In this specific Rewind episode, I actually went back and re-recorded the original episode as part of my ongoing project to review old episodes involving minor victims and offenders to ensure I've properly anonymized everyone. And since I spent so much time on it, and there were updates to include, I thought, why not release it? So that's what you're hearing today. This episode is sponsored by IntegriSure. I talk about some of the most serious crimes on this podcast, but crimes like smash and grabs and house break-ins happen much more frequently, and accidents happen too. As a podcaster and freelancer, I rely heavily on my laptop and phone. If something happened to them and I wasn't insured, it would be a huge problem. Plus, you'd all definitely be asking where the next episode is. IntegriSure has been operating as one of South Africa's top short-term insurance brokers for almost 30 years. And I know that as I've gotten older, I've definitely felt more of a need to protect what I've built through hard work with a broker that understands me. IntegriSure doesn't just do car and home insurance, though. They also think about the stuff you probably wouldn't even consider until you need it. Road and home assist, advice from experienced brokers, and a range of value-add products like pet insurance. Because somehow, Fluffy always seems to get into it with the neighbor's cat when the budget is already tight. We all try to be intentional about protecting ourselves, and that should definitely apply to your choice in insurance brokers too. Visit www.integrisure.co.za to connect. IntegriSure, car, home and business insurance for the generation that does not take chances. IntegriSure is an authorized financial services provider. This episode was first released in the True Crime South Africa feed on the 23rd of February 2020. Listen through to the end for a current update. This episode has been edited and re-recorded since its initial release to comply with the changing legal landscape. The names of all minor victims have been changed to protect their identities. Welcome to True Crime South Africa. I'm your host, Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to Episode 21, The Crimes of Advocate Barbie. I've been researching today's case for quite a while and decided to cover it this week. In doing my final round of research, though, I found some rabbit holes. And then I discovered that those rabbit holes had rabbit holes of their own. Eventually, I was so deep in this case that I was using Google Translate to read Russian newspapers. No, really. That will all make sense later, I promise. I also wondered about what to call this episode for a while. There were two perpetrators in this case, Suzanne Fissin and Dirk Prinsloo. Well, technically I still have to call Dirk Prinsloo an alleged perpetrator, because he is yet to stand trial for the charges against him. And as a disclaimer, anything that I say about Dirk Prinsloo in this episode has been taken from news articles, a book written about the case, as well as Suzanne Fissin and others' testimonies in court. So, with that said, it seems that it would not be entirely fair to reference Dirk Prinsloo in the name of the episode. Instead, I called it The Crimes of Advocate Barbie. The major resource I used to research this case was a book called Shattered Lives, written by Laurie Peters and Liesl Tom. Laurie worked for Dirk Prinsloo as his PA for a short period, and Liesl Tom is a journalist. The book is a mixture of fact and opinion, as well as insights from Laurie. What it does really well is tell the victims' stories. I was unable to find this book for sale on any major electronic platform, but thankfully Laurie had uploaded a good part of it to a writer's website called Wattpad, and I was able to read it there. The crimes involved in this case took place in 2001 and 2002. One of the perpetrators was only eventually brought to trial in 2010, and the other still has not been. This case is different for a few reasons. Firstly, it's quite rare for a female to be implicated in sex crimes, at least publicly and in a court of law. And that's not necessarily because it doesn't happen. I think it's more because female sex offenders slip between the cracks of what we as a society believe to be true about women, just like female murderers. We like to make ourselves believe that women only commit crimes like these when they're forced to. Of course, that's completely untrue and quite short-sighted, and we'll delve into that a little bit later. It's for this reason that this case divided the public when it happened. It still does today. In fact, I don't even know that I've made up my mind entirely. Some people believe that Suzanne Fissin was as much a victim as the other victims in this case. And others believe that she was and is a cold-blooded perpetrator who, along with her lover, targeted children to make their sexual fantasies a reality. Or maybe it was a bit of both, if that's even possible. I think I'm going to have to let you decide for yourself. So, let's get into episode 21, The Crimes of Advocate Barbie. The names of minor victims in this episode have been changed to protect their identities. Suzanne Fissin was born to her parents, Johan and Susanne Fissin, when Susanne was in her first year of university. The couple had been childhood sweethearts, but when Susanne had fallen pregnant, she was apparently devastated. Coming from a deeply religious background, the couple were forced to marry, and neither family was very happy about it. Suzanne was allegedly aware that her birth had not been planned, and this apparently did impact her as a person. Susanne and Johan's relationship deteriorated very quickly after Suzanne was born, and domestic violence was a common theme in the Fissin household. Suzanne was an only child, and although she claims to have never witnessed her father hitting her mother, she saw the bruises, and she understood from a very young age that her role in the house was to placate her father, just as her mother did. When his anger started to boil over, it wasn't long before it would erupt. So Suzanne learned to distract him by siding with him and faking illnesses. It's alleged that Johann Fusser would often threaten to kill his wife and daughter, and then himself. Under these threats of familicide, her mother put on a facade for the outside world. They were the perfect Fusser family, with a studious and polite little angel girl. This was Cezanne's first instruction on how to keep your man happy at all costs. Fellow students at Montana High School describe Cezanne as gentle and introverted. She did very well academically and was deputy head girl in primary school and a prefect in high school. She focused predominantly on academics, but dabbled in sports and cultural activities as well. It's quite a feat that Cezanne did so well in school, because at the time her father worked for the National Intelligence Agency, and they moved several times throughout her childhood. Her mother did divorce her father at some stage, but they reunited and remarried, and by the time Cezanne matriculated and started her first year at university for her law degree, they were together again. Cezanne Fusser is no one's fool. She passed 2 degrees before applying to the bar to complete her articles. Cezanne was 24 years old at this time, and allegedly still very inexperienced in intimate relationships. After an alleged unrequited crush situation from Cezanne's side toward her mentor while she was doing her articles, she sat for her bar exam, and for the first time in her life, she failed. She then joined the Independent Bar of South Africa, referred to in law circles as the Rogue Bar. The chairman of the Rogue Bar was a man 8 years Cezanne's senior, Dirk Prinsloo. Dirk was an advocate who his colleagues referred to as a stain on the name of the law profession. He ran a seemingly successful private practice from his extremely lavish home on the outskirts of Pretoria. As guests and clients would drive up to the residence, a sign on the front gates proclaimed its name as Inner Circle Castle. No, really. I'm serious. That's what he called his house. Dirk Prinsloo was a man who was very much concerned with appearances. He spent hours at the gym honing his physique and dressed only in label brand clothing. Apparently, right down to his underwear and socks. If you heard people describing Dirk and you didn't know they were referring to one person, you'd be forgiven for assuming they were referring to several different people. He'd been described as everything from the kindest man I've ever met, to a charmer, a manipulator, polite, charismatic, socially slick, and extremely flirtatious. And the crowning glory was the women, who described having the hairs on the back of their neck stand up when he was near them. Dirk Prinsloo had wanted to be an advocate for as long as he could remember. As a child, he marked his underpants with a permanent marker with the words Advocates Prinsloo. He has 2 brothers and is close with his father, it appears. No mention is made of his mother, though. Dirk, like Cezanne, excelled in school, but he made no impression on the people around him. Schoolmates couldn't even remember him when they were tracked down for comment. He had no relationships in school, and those he did have in university were apparently quite normal for his age group. Dirk's father would later rack his mind to try and figure out where he'd gone wrong as a parent. Unlike Cezanne's parents, he would never claim that his son was innocent of the crimes of which he was accused. Despite Dirk's high IQ, he was described as having a very low EQ, and he made a bit of trouble for himself. He was known as a troublemaker and a bully, especially toward women, and he had a very short temper. Dirk held his own name in very high regard. His CV was laminated, and his business cards were made of hard perspex. He was also extremely paranoid and fiercely private. He refused to allow anyone onto his property without an appointment, and once smashed a glass table of one of his PAs because she allowed the sheriff of the court onto the premises without an appointment. He regularly told people that the government, police, and several judicial bodies were out to get him because he was fighting for people's rights. In reality, Laurie would later comment that the only clients she ever saw Dirk with were foreign immigrants who needed assistance getting visas. He also represented a few people accused of sex crimes against children. He managed to maintain a pretty expensive lifestyle, though, so I'm assuming the clients he did have were paying top dollar for his services. At the time that Suzanne Fisser joined the Rogue Bar, Dirk Prinsloo had recently separated from his wife, Elsie. The woman had been his previous legal secretary, and Laurie remembered seeing a photograph of her once. She said she looked exactly like Faith Hill. When she commented on how beautiful she was, Dirk had told Laurie that she had looked nothing like that when he'd met her. He said, "I made her into that." Those words would ring ominously in Laurie's ears as future events unfolded. Apparently innocent and naive, Suzanne Fisser was immediately in awe of Dirk Prinsloo, and he took an instant liking to the young advocate as well. Ever the social butterfly, Dirk invited Suzanne and two of her female colleagues to his house one weekend for a braai. Although she was one of many guests, the others would later say that he only had eyes for Suzanne that day. He gave her a tour of his sprawling mansion, and Suzanne, being from a middle-class home, was dumbstruck at the opulence around her, as well as this intelligent and successful man who was looking at her as though she was the only person in the room. This visit would be the beginning of Suzanne and Dirk's relationship. She went home that night, back to her parents' home, where she still lived. But soon Dirk was declaring his undying love for her. He called her princess and seemed to worship the very ground she walked on. Suzanne was swept away on this wave of adoration. Very soon, Dirk started to make sexual demands of Suzanne. She says she explained that she was a virgin and had absolutely no experience with sex at all. She would later allege that at this point, he had shown her a pornographic movie and then told her to perform oral sex on him in the way the woman had in the movie. Suzanne, having been raised to do what was required to keep the man at the house happy, did what she was told. I do want to say at this point that the perspective we have on Suzanne and Dirk's relationship comes from Suzanne herself, as well as a few witnesses who were unlucky enough to witness some of the interactions. We don't know if this representation is 100% accurate, but for now, that's all we have. And mostly, it is backed up by some evidence. Dirk convinced Suzanne to leave her parents' home and move in with him. Her parents, deeply conservative people, were horrified. But Suzanne was convinced that Dirk was her future husband, and she had never felt so absolutely adored by any person in her life. This act of over-the-top displays of adoration, praise, expensive gifts, and just general creepiness is called love bombing. It's a very common tactic used by people who are trying to get prospective partners, friends, or even employees under their control. We all have a pretty good idea of what the early days of a relationship look like. It's usually fun, a little awkward perhaps, and generally it moves pretty slowly as you both get to know each other. With love bombing, you'll experience major intensity very early on. So much so that it takes you aback. And while it's lovely to feel so adored and cared for, it somehow doesn't feel right because this person barely knows you. Well, for the often narcissistic person extending this behavior, they know you just well enough to know that they want to control you. Because you haven't had time to see their negative personality traits yet, you don't see the invisible binds that are being placed around you with each gift, compliment, and declaration of love until it's too late. I don't know when Suzanne realized that Dirk Prinsloo was not entirely the knight in shining armor he'd made himself out to be, but their first night together was probably a good indicator. Suzanne would later describe her first penetrative sexual experience with Dirk as brutal. He knew she was inexperienced, but apparently made no effort to make the experience enjoyable for her. Later, she lay next to him and did what she learned to do throughout her life. Once again, she told him it was an amazing experience. Dirk's promises to Suzanne included that he was going to make her an international model. She was going to be a celebrity, he said, famous across the world. And he didn't think that she should even work as an advocate anymore, because it would only get in the way of her bright new future with him. Economic control. You don't have to work anymore. I'll take care of you. And in the process, access to your own money and financial independence is lost. Dirk wasn't completely wrong, though. He did make Suzanne famous, or rather, infamous. She would have a hand in that too, of course. He promised that everyone would know her name, and we do. Dirk started designing the new Suzanne without delay. A pretty, but rather ordinary girl, would eventually have three breast enhancement operations. She went from a B cup to a double E. Strangely, Suzanne would state in court that she was only aware of two breast enlargements. She'd been sure that the last operation was actually to reduce her breast size, as she'd complained to Dirk of severe back pain. Medical records proved that she did, in fact, have three enlargement procedures. All had been booked, arranged, and paid for by Dirk Prinsloo, and the surgeon had simply slapped implant on top of implant. Laurie had said that when she'd seen Suzanne changing, she'd noticed how malformed her breasts were. The redesigning of Suzanne continued with tattoos, including one at the top of her bikini line of Dirk's name. The word branding comes to mind, and not the marketing kind either. Suzanne's hair was peroxided to a white shade of blonde, and she was given extensions. She had fat removed from her buttocks and injected into her lips. Dirk took her to the gym twice a day, 6 days a week, and trained her himself. Observers noted that although she looked like she could pass out at any minute, she continued to push herself to please Dirk. Suzanne's body was never quite good enough, though, and many of Dirk's secretaries reported seeing Suzanne naked standing on a chair while Dirk scrubbed her buttocks and thighs with anti-cellulite products for hours. She wore contact lenses to change her eye color. She had a nose job and several piercings, including one in her genitals. She wore ridiculously revealing clothes, which were allegedly chosen by Dirk. On one occasion, the couple was seen parading through Menland Mall with Suzanne wearing a see-through outfit that Dirk had purchased at a sex shop. You don't ever have to have seen outfits at a sex shop to imagine that they are probably not appropriate attire for malls. Another method of control that Suzanne would allege was used against her was food. She claimed that she made extravagant meals for Dirk, but she was never allowed to eat them, because she may gain weight. Instead, she had to have a meal replacement shake, this was actually witnessed by Laurie. When Dirk and Suzanne ate at her house one evening, they each had a plate of food. And then, when Laurie's mom wanted to dish up seconds, Suzanne handed over a plate, and Dirk gave her the dirtiest look, which quickly changed her mind. Laurie was, however, a little skeptical about Suzanne saying that she cooked for Dirk every night, because his housekeeper, who had somehow managed to stay employed with him for many years, cooked meals in advance for Dirk as part of her duties. Having left her law career behind, Suzanne became Dirk's assistant, doing menial tasks for him. Mostly, though, Suzanne was there to service Dirk's sexual desires. And I will warn you that at this point, things get a bit strange. Dirk Prinsloo reportedly had an insatiable sexual appetite, which he seemed to believe was Suzanne's responsibility to keep satiated. Every person that entered Dirk's home spoke about his huge collection of pornography. Magazines lay open around the entire house. The couple's bedroom contained two ceiling-high cupboards filled with pornographic movies. Sex toys littered the floor, and Dirk's housekeeper was forced to wash them daily. Dirk allegedly insisted on Suzanne performing oral sex on him whenever he demanded it. He didn't care if someone else was in the room at the time. Many of his PAs reported being in the room when Dirk quite suddenly unzipped his pants and pushed Suzanne's head down into his crotch. Suzanne's parents, although experiencing their own issues and on the verge of their second divorce, were extremely unhappy with what their daughter was doing. The shocking physical changes she'd undergone were the tipping point, and they made such efforts to get Suzanne away from Dirk that Suzanne ended up taking a protection order against her parents. Isolation from family and friends. One of the steps in taking complete control of a partner is stopping any contact between them and those who love them. When the person no longer has a support network, they are far easier to manipulate. Dirk's sexual interest often involved threesomes and swinging. He would allegedly send Suzanne out to scout for sex workers that suited her lover's taste. Frequently, he wanted Suzanne to have sex with them first. During this time, Dirk decided to make his first move to increase Suzanne's public image. Despite the fact that she could not hold a musical note, he entered her into a singing competition called South African Idols. She actually made it all the way through to the second round of the competition, which, to be honest, doesn't say much about the quality of the competition. But Suzanne was not there for her singing talent. She rocketed into the public eye as people ogled her physical appearance and found it so strange that she was also an advocate. Suzanne's nickname was born in the media. After this audition, she became known as Advocate Barbie. What also sparked from this audition was additional press attention for the couple. They were interviewed on a talk show by Big Brother winner Ferdinand Rabi, who spent the entire interview lusting after Suzanne. She started the interview dressed in traditional advocate's garb and then stripped down on camera into a tiny bikini. Rabi ended this interview by signing one of Suzanne's breasts and asking Dirk's permission, please note, to kiss her other breast. Dirk readily agreed and smiled throughout, seemingly eager to see how his creation was being adored. The Bar Association opened a case against the couple after this interview for bringing the profession into disrepute. Suzanne's mother decided to go to the press herself and gave an interview about her daughter being controlled and manipulated by Dirk. This only served to increase the rift between mother and daughter. Suzanne then replied with her own article professing her undying love for Dirk and saying that he was helping her and she'd never been loved the way he loved her. Just to give you an idea of the timeline, this is all happening within weeks and months of Suzanne moving in with Dirk. Also, within weeks of her moving in, his sexual control over her became much more violent and pronounced. He also rarely called her princess anymore. His new name for her was slut. She, in turn, called him God. Witnesses would later testify that Suzanne had Dirk saved in her cell phone as God. She addressed him as God in letters and signed off as your slut. Suzanne would later claim that this was Dirk's way of mocking the religious conviction she'd grown up with. Dirk allegedly did not think that Suzanne should hold any being in greater regard than him. He further reinforced his mockery of her beliefs on a holiday in Mossel Bay. While driving, she said they came across a chapel on the side of the road. He took Suzanne inside and allegedly forcibly penetrated her while holding her down on the altar of the church. He would allegedly assault Suzanne during sex and force her to walk around the house naked. His PAs would later confirm that they had regularly seen Suzanne naked at the house. Dirk apparently had a predilection for using foreign objects during sex. He kept a revolver under his pillow, which Suzanne said he had used to penetrate her. She, in turn, and perhaps harping back to her childhood, where she learned to distract to avoid anger, started to use vegetables to penetrate herself to distract him when he became angry. He took photographs of her in compromising positions. One such photograph shows a seemingly unconscious Suzanne with a dog collar around her neck, shackled to the bed. Her body is bruised, and she would later say that when she came to, Dirk had told her that he had forced his dogs to lick her genitals. While he regularly forced her to have sex with other women, no other man was allowed to touch her. He threatened her by saying he was going to arrange 10 mine workers to rape her. He allegedly forced her to drink his urine as a sign of her complete devotion to him. Suzanne started using Dirk's surname. She claimed that he had convinced her that because they were now living together, they were common law man and wife. When a judge later asked her how someone with 2 law degrees could believe she was married if she hadn't had a legal ceremony or signed her intent to marry, Suzanne said that she wasn't thinking with her legal brain at the time. Laurie, the secretary, says that there's no way that Suzanne could have believed she was married to Dirk because she was well aware that Dirk was still married to his former wife. They were in the midst of a battle because Elsie wanted more of their marital assets than he was willing to give. Dirk had referenced this on several occasions in front of Laurie and Suzanne, once allegedly even saying that he was thinking about hiring a hitman to kill Elsie. It's inconsistencies like this that make me wonder how deep under Dirk's control Suzanne really was. Speaking of Laurie, let's get into what she and the rest of Dirk's PAs witnessed and endured at the Inner Circle Castle. Dirk's fits of rage and the extremely strange goings-on at the home, which doubled as an office, meant that Suzanne was advertising for new PAs almost constantly. Laurie is, of course, one of the authors of the book Shattered Lives, and she has both good and bad things to say about the couple. In her interview for the job, Laurie almost immediately knew something was a bit off. When Dirk asked her how she felt about pornography, she answered that she didn't really have an opinion on it, but it was something she wasn't personally interested in. Laurie was hired. She had a legal background, and she was well qualified for the position. She also ran a graphic design business and did tell Dirk about this, and he agreed that she could continue to do both. Laurie says that Dirk was a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde type character. You never knew who you were going to get. She says she wouldn't describe him as a tyrant. And even when he was in the midst of a rage, she still felt that if she voiced her opinion, he would stand down and listen. She would be the only one who would say that. And I think maybe that comes down to Laurie's own strong personality and perhaps her qualifications. Dirk also helped with a few legal issues that Laurie had in her own life. And when he did so, he was kind and compassionate. Laurie did say that Dirk wanted to be a lord and master of every person in his life. He wanted to control the actions of everyone. Laurie also spoke about the huge amount of pornography around the house and the fact that the couple regularly touched each other's genitals in her presence. Laurie remained in contact with Suzanne's mother long after all of this blew up. That all started when the woman phoned one day wanting to speak to her daughter. Laurie had absolutely no idea that there was a rift between mother and daughter, so when Suzanne phoned, she told her that she would give Suzanne the message. The minute that Dirk heard her put down the phone and found out who'd been on the line, he flew into a rage. He told her that Suzanne had a protection order against her mother because she was trying to tear them apart and she didn't want what was best for her daughter. By that point, Laurie had witnessed Dirk's treatment of Suzanne, the violence, the insults, and the controlling behavior. Suzanne had sounded so desperate on the phone that Laurie felt sorry for her. The next time the woman phoned, rather than telling her not to call back as Dirk had instructed, Laurie gave the woman her home phone number. From that day, she would give her updates on Suzanne without Dirk's knowledge. Laurie would say that she saw two very different sides to Suzanne. They became friendly and bonded when Suzanne would cry to Laurie over Dirk's treatments of her. But she also saw a side that she described as darker. She says Suzanne milked her sexuality. She didn't seem at all put out by what Dirk had created in her physically. In fact, she told Laurie that the feeling of men lusting after her as she walked around and women gawking at her was addictive. She described it as the ultimate control and a rush that she could not live without. Laurie was not employed by Dirk for very long. She left when he and Suzanne started to sexually groom her. They gave her skimpy lingerie for her birthday and made no secrets about the fact that they wanted her to try it on for them. Laurie resigned that day, but she stayed in contact with the couple doing some touch-ups on photographs for them. The photographs were definitely not intended to make Suzanne an international fashion model, perhaps an international porn star, but nothing else. The photos that Laurie was asked to touch up also included pictures of the couple in sex acts, alone as well as with other people, who she couldn't identify. One photograph disturbed Laurie. It was a picture of Dirk and Suzanne laying naked on a bed. Dirk appeared to be masturbating, and two naked red-headed females sat on the floor massaging their feet. Laurie said that the girls didn't look underage to her. It was just a disturbing image. Laurie still hoped that she could help Suzanne to escape from Dirk. And when she came to collect the photographs, she asked her how she felt about what people were saying about her in the media. At this time, photographs had been leaked by an employee at a photo shop. They were pornographic photos of Suzanne, and they'd initially been confiscated from schoolboys at a nearby high school. These photos ended up in the hands of a newspaper who wanted to publish them. Dirk sent a cease and desist order to the newspaper regarding the release of the photos, but the damage was already done. The public image of the couple was now high profile for their sexual escapades. They were popular for being such an odd combination of a profession that was supposed to be ethical and hold itself to a high standard, and this insane private life they seemed to lead. Cezanne's response to Laurie's question about the bad publicity was that there was no such thing as bad publicity. "It's all good," she claimed. I somehow think she may have a different answer to that question if she was asked today. On this day, Laurie had also noted that Cezanne had a new car. Her old blue Honda that she owned was gone and replaced with a maroon 4x4. Cezanne said at the time that the car was hers and that Dirk had bought it for her. Dirk later denied this when Laurie asked him, though, and he said it was his car and he just let her use it. The reality was that Dirk had told Cezanne they should sell her car and she could get the money and then he would buy her a new car and register it in her name. He did sell her car, but he kept the money and never registered the new car in her name. Mirsha Jacobs was another personal assistant of Dirk's. She worked for them before Laurie did. That's Mirsha is not her real name. She was only able to work for Dirk for 7 days. Mirsha testified to having seen interactions between the couple that ranged from extreme violence to sexual acts conducted right in front of her. One of the reasons that Mirsha's real name is not being used is because she was also a victim of Dirk's sexual abuse. Mirsha was sexually assaulted by Dirk Prinsloo and forced to perform oral sex on him. After the incidents, he left the house. She removed every trace of her contact information from the premises and left. When a friend of Mirsha's found out what had happened, she advised her to go to the police. Mirsha had to go to hospital to be examined for police records, and the doctor that examined her said that she was in such a state of shock that he had no doubt she had been assaulted. Unfortunately, due to the nature of the sexual assault, physical evidence could not be recovered. But the doctor noted that her emotional reaction was similar to other rape victims he had examined. The doctor wrote out a sick note, excusing her from work for the next few days, or permanently, if need be. He faxed the note to Dirk from his offices. Within minutes, Dirk was on the phone to the doctor. He demanded to know exactly what Mirsha had told him and what his physical findings had been. He also wanted a copy of the report that the doctor had submitted to the police. The doctor told him that he was not bound to release that information to him, and he could contact the police instead. In what would become a pattern for Dirk Prinsloo, whenever he was accused of anything, he struck back by laying a false charge of theft against Mirsha. He claimed that she had stolen 10,000 rand from him, and Cezanne submitted a statement agreeing that this had happened. She went on to say that the sex acts between Dirk and Mirsha were consensual because she'd been there, which is absolutely untrue. Mirsha Jacobs would later have her charges against Dirk included in the trial against the couple. Rihanna Brink was hired as Dirk's PA after Laurie left. She knew Cezanne from having worked at the independent bar together, and they'd been friendly at the time, socializing and going to restaurants and pubs together. When Rihanna saw the adverts in the newspaper for a PA position, she had no idea that this was Cezanne's partner. When she arrived at Inner Circle Castle on the day of the interview and Cezanne opened the door, she actually didn't recognize her. Such was the dramatic physical transformation the woman had undergone. Cezanne recognized Rihanna, though. And Rihanna said she could not believe how different she looked. She too was asked the pornography question in her interview. Rihanna was in a very difficult period in her life and was desperate for a job. She and her husband had recently split up. They were also in a fierce custody battle for their daughter. Rihanna had to get a job and a place to stay within weeks in order to gain shared custody of her daughter, who was with her husband at the time. In the interview, Dirk informed Rihanna that she would be working for him 24/7. While she would only be at the office during working hours, she had to be ready to spring into action if he needed anything at any time of the day or night, including on weekends. And she shouldn't expect any overtime pay for that either. Most people would turn down such conditions, but Rihanna was so desperate that she accepted. For the first few days, Rihanna enjoyed the job. But soon, Dirk started to demean her, constantly. Then he escalated to physical violence. He made her stand to attention at any time he entered the room. If she wasn't fast enough, he hit her back down into her chair. By this time, Dirk was well aware of her battle for custody and would intersperse his violence with offers to help her with money or to pay lawyers or to put a deposit down on a property. This reeling in of a person with kindness, especially when they're in a desperate situation, only to turn on them and demean or assault them, is another typical pattern of abusive behaviour. Dirk knew that he had Rihanna exactly where he wanted any woman in his orbit. She consulted with her family court advocate, who was dealing with the custody case, and she told him what Dirk was doing. Sadly, the advocate simply told her that if she left her job, she would be deemed unstable and would lose custody of her daughter. Rather than helping her, he pushed her even deeper into Dirk's clutches. Rihanna eventually won shared custody of her daughter. But on the Saturday that she was supposed to come home, Dirk suddenly called Rihanna back into the office for an emergency. Rihanna had wanted to give her little girl a wonderful homecoming, which Dirk very well knew. Instead, she'd had to fetch her the next morning, after typing documents throughout the night, which could have waited until Monday. Rihanna would later testify that there was only one computer at the practice, which was connected to the internet, and she didn't have the password to it. Suzanne would sit at that computer for hours, downloading pornographic images for Dirk. Many of these, police would later find, were images of children being sexually assaulted. One day, Suzanne approached Rihanna with a photograph of a little blonde girl. The photograph depicted a sexual act being perpetrated upon her. Suzanne quite lightly told the horrified Rihanna that the girl looked just like her cousin, and she allegedly seemed quite excited about the fact. The amount of pornography in the house was another huge problem for Rihanna. She said that you could not go anywhere in the house without seeing an open magazine depicting violent sex acts. She had to look after Inner Castle when the couple went away, and she begged the housekeeper to help her pack away the magazines so that she didn't have to see them the whole weekend. The housekeeper refused, saying that Dirk knew exactly what page each of the magazines was open on and its location in the house. If they moved one, he would know. The housekeeper said she'd fallen foul of having moved a magazine before while cleaning and had paid dearly for it. Rihanna says that Dirk Prinsloo watched pornographic videos or looked at pornographic pictures almost constantly. He even had porn movies playing in his office while he was supposed to be working. She would be forced to watch Suzanne perform oral sex on him. Dirk told Rihanna that a woman's worth was based in how well she was able to perform oral sex. Rihanna would also be a witness to an even darker event in the house, and one that spoke to something very different happening behind the scenes. A doctor friend of Dirk's allegedly regularly delivered medications to his house without prescription, according to Rihanna. The two predominant medicines delivered were Viagra and Rohypnol. The former is, of course, a drug to boost male sexual performance, while the latter, although prescribed as a sleeping aid in some countries, is commonly known as the date rape drug and is frequently used by sexual predators to incapacitate victims to rape them. Rihanna described an incident where Cezanne had invited her to visit a beauty salon with her. They'd had their nails done, and then they had a Brazilian wax. When they returned to the house, Dirk insisted on seeing what he'd paid for, and he wasn't talking about their nails. Rihanna was forced to stand beside Cezanne, who'd removed her pants completely, and expose her bikini area. Rihanna says she pulled down her pants just enough to expose the skin, and Dirk took a photograph. Dirk constantly found things that he claimed Rihanna had done wrong and punished her by deducting money from her salary to repay the mistake. On one occasion, Dirk had accidentally driven over and killed one of his Jack Russell dogs, and he instructed Rihanna to wrap the dog in a duvet and take its body to the vet for cremation. When she returned, he asked her where the duvet was, and when she admitted that she'd left the blood-stained duvet with the dog at the vet, he deducted 400 rand from her salary to replace it. Of all of the abuse that Rihanna endured at the hands of Dirk Prinsloo, what put her over the edge seemed mild in comparison, as is so often the case in these types of situations. It's often the proverbial straw that breaks the camel's back. The victim is so overloaded with anxiety and fear that one small incident pushes them to make a change. 6 months after Rihanna had started working for Dirk, her father came to visit from Namibia. She was over the moon to be able to spend time with him, and Dirk saw this, and likely wasn't too keen on her being quite that happy. He instructed her that she had to work that weekend, so she wouldn't be able to see her father after all. After that, Rihanna never returned to Inner Circle Castle. An attorney friend of hers helped her to put together a complaint of constructive dismissal and sent it to Dirk. Constructive dismissal is a term used in labor law when an employee essentially leaves an employer but states that they have only done so because the employer has made their working circumstances unbearable to endure, and they're left with no other choice. It is a very difficult charge to prove, as the onus is solely on the employee to prove that the situation was unbearable and that they followed all other possible routes before resigning. Dirk ignored the complaint and started to stalk Rihanna, demanding that she return to work. He phoned her family members and anyone else he could link her to. Eventually, true to his nature, he laid a charge of theft against her, despite the fact that he hadn't paid Rihanna for her last month's salary. He charged her with theft because she hadn't paid him in full for furniture she'd bought from him. Rihanna struggled financially after leaving her job and eventually lost her car because she couldn't pay for it. It's alleged that Dirk arranged for two private investigators to pose as police officers and approach Rihanna for a statement so that he could find out what she was willing to say about him and how much she knew. To put you in the timeline here, we're now in December 2001 and early 2002. Dirk and Cezanne approached Samantha to replace Rihanna as a secretary. At the time, the couple knew Samantha from a Photoshop they'd taken their reels of film to be developed. Yes, those photos. Samantha was understandably hesitant and agreed to work for Dirk as a trial run, but she didn't resign from her other job. And this was an incredibly smart move, because she ended up working for Dirk for one day and never returned. They did stay in touch, though, through the Photoshop, and one day the couple invited Samantha to their home for dinner. Samantha agreed and they ate a chicken stir fry. While they were eating, Dirk suggested that Suzanne pour them some shooters. Samantha started to get up to help, but Dirk pulled her back down, saying that Suzanne would take care of it. Samantha reports that after drinking the shooter, she started to feel extremely unwell. She was no stranger to drinking shooters as a young person, and had never felt that way from alcohol before. She describes feeling groggy and like her limbs were heavy, as though she was unable to control her own body. She was aware of bits and pieces of what happened next, but couldn't recall everything. These are classic side effects of Rohypnol. One of the things that Samantha remembers was both Dirk and Suzanne kissing her and fondling her, and she couldn't remember anything after that. Suzanne would later claim that Dirk had been the one to prepare the drinks and that she'd had no idea he drugged Samantha. She says that she thought that what was happening was consensual. She does say that they didn't have sex with Samantha that night. But considering she's lying about whether she thought the acts were consensual, because she must have seen that after just one shooter, Samantha was basically unconscious, I don't know if we can really believe that Samantha was not raped that night. This is the last of the testimonies from Dirk's secretaries. Many of these women would likely have kept their stories to themselves if it hadn't been for the couple's eventual arrest. Which begs the question. If Dirk was going through PAs at the rough rate of one every fortnight, how many other women were assaulted by this couple who chose not to come forward? I decided to get into the testimony of the secretaries who were also victims first. But I must point out that at the same time that these women were working for Dirk and Suzanne, there were also other sex crimes taking place in the house, which would be the reason the couple were eventually arrested. Those crimes were against children. One victim was as young as 11 years old. And that's what I'll get into next. Just to remind you, the names of minor victims in this episode have been changed to protect their identities. Many witnesses testified to Dirk Prinsloo's interest in young sex workers. And when I say young, we're talking 14 and 15. So not actual sex workers, despite them getting paid, I guess. To be very clear, this is sex trafficking in minors. Many of these victims had been through terrible events in their own lives, and sometimes they'd developed substance use disorders, and they'd found themselves in the sex trade as the only way to feed themselves, and for some, their addictions. One of Suzanne's duties was to visit sex trade establishments to find the youngest sex workers available. These girls would later say that from their perspective, she was more predatory than any male client they'd ever had. Suzanne testified in court that Dirk was no longer happy with the 14-year-old sex workers and instructed her to find a way to get younger girls for him. Suzanne came up with a plan to approach children's homes and told them that she wanted to foster girls for the weekend to spoil them and mentor them. Suzanne was big news at the time, and her beauty and fame impressed many of the homes she approached and had the young girls in awe of her. Some of the homes she approached declined to allow girls to go home with them for the weekend, but several seemingly had no problem doing so. When the people in charge of these homes were later questioned, it emerged that they had no official screening process in place for couples who wanted to foster on weekends, save a short interview. This honestly blows my mind. But after this case was brought to light, it is alleged that stricter procedures were put in place. And I can only hope that is true. Apparently, it didn't seem strange to the people in charge of these homes that Suzanne solely selected girls based on their appearance. She wanted the girls to be as young as possible, but also already slightly developed, and they had to be pretty and slim. If this wasn't a red flag, then I don't know what was. It seems that Dirk had taught Suzanne well enough in terms of how to manipulate people, because none of the people she dealt with ever thought anything was off with her. In contrast, they told the girls that had been chosen how lucky they were to be mentored and spend time with such an amazing, intelligent, and accomplished woman. The stories of three of the victims were discussed in the book Shattered Lives. Whether there are more victims, we don't know. It's entirely possible. Because all of these victims were minors, their identities were kept under wraps, even in court. And a lot of the actual court transcripts which contained identifying information would be redacted and not publicly released. The first girl taken home for the weekend was a 15-year-old we will call Anya. Anya was keen to go with Suzanne and Dirk when she was told that she'd been chosen, because she had ambitions of being a lawyer one day, and she was excited to learn from the couple. To put you back in the timeline of events, the Friday that Anya was collected by Dirk was the same day that Suzanne was auditioning for the Idols competition. Anya would later testify that after Dirk picked her up, they went grocery shopping. Up until that point, she'd been enjoying conversation with Dirk and using the opportunity to pick his brain about his career. When they got back into the car after doing shopping, they realized that they'd left a bottle of cooking oil in the shop, and Dirk asked her to run inside and fetch it. Anya, eager to please, did exactly that as quickly as she could. When she jogged back to the car and handed Dirk the cooking oil, he told her that she looked sexy when she ran. Anya said that not only did she think that this was creepy because a man of his age was saying this to her, but she found it weird that someone would find running sexy. Little did she know that the man sitting next to her was capable of finding some very strange things arousing. He then asked Anya what her views on sex before marriage were. She said that she wanted to remain a virgin until she was married. On arriving at Inner Circle Castle, of course, Anya was blown away by the opulence and the beauty of the house, but she very quickly crashed down back to earth when she saw a trophy standing on the kitchen counter. It read, and I'm going to say this in a way that doesn't set off any explicit content rules with the platforms, best effer. But it had the whole word on it. This had apparently been a gift from Suzanne to Dirk. Beside it was a note addressed to my God and signed off as your slut. Anya was horrified, but that would all be eclipsed when she walked into the couple's bedroom. Of course, they'd made no effort to hide their enormous porn collection, numerous sex toys or sexual bondage items, considering they were having a child over for the weekend. In contrast, Dirk seemed excited to see Anya's reaction. She was completely nauseated. Sadly, her weekend would just get worse. Suzanne eventually returned home from the Idols audition, and the couple celebrated her success by forcing Anya to watch while Suzanne performed oral sex on Dirk. Anya started crying, and Dirk told her to go to her room if she didn't want to learn. She fled immediately. The couple allegedly apologized to her afterwards. The next day, Suzanne told Anya that they were going shopping. As soon as they were in the dressing room alone, Suzanne stripped naked and showed Anya her genital piercings. She allowed Anya to choose clothing, but ignored her statement that she wore a medium size and instead purchased everything in extra small. Suzanne chastised Anya, saying that if she wanted men to look at her and lust after her, then she had to give them something to look at. The rest of the shopping trip involved Anya being forced to watch Suzanne having a Brazilian wax, and she declined her insistence that she should get one too. Then they visited a doctor where Anya watched fat being taken from Suzanne's buttocks and injected into her lips. Anya could not wait for the weekend with the couple to be over and was bitterly disappointed and traumatized at what she'd been forced to witness. She was glad when the couple told her on Saturday night that they were going out and she'd be alone for the night. Dirk told her that he'd left a movie in the video recorder for her. True to his predatory patterns, when Anya pressed play, she was met with the sight of a porn movie. The next morning, they ate breakfast under the Lapa, and Anya noted that Dirk ate his breakfast while paging through a porn magazine. He looked up at her once and asked her how she washed her genitals. She refused to answer. Then Suzanne started asking Anya about another girl from the same children's home. The girl was called Charmaine and was just 11 years old. Anya had never spoken to Charmaine, so she had no information to offer. But Suzanne pressed on, specifically wanting to know whether Charmaine had experienced any sexual abuse. Now, I have no idea what was behind this line of questioning, but the couple were clearly not out to avoid traumatizing anyone. So the only logical conclusion that I can reach is that this predatory pair were actively seeking out children who had already been groomed and preyed on by other pedophiles, as perhaps they believed it would be easier to target those victims, which is just incredibly disgusting. The couple later performed sex acts in front of Anya again, and then Suzanne offered to colour Anya's hair for her. Taking advantage of the fact that Anya couldn't go anywhere, she used the opportunity to explain to the child in great detail how to perform oral sex on a man. Anya was overjoyed to be returned to the children's home that afternoon. She did not immediately tell anyone what had happened because she was embarrassed and just wanted to move on. Her story would only come out after other complaints had been laid against the couple. Suzanne informed the home that the next girl they wanted to take for the weekend would be 11-year-old Charmaine, also not her real name. This choice was allegedly met with a bit of resistance from the home because Charmaine was deeply scarred from a difficult childhood and had not been at the home for very long. In their opinion, she was also too young to be fostered for the weekend. Charmaine herself had also stated that she didn't want to go with the couple. She was extremely shy and still adjusting to having been removed from her family, and she would later say that she got a bad feeling about Dirk. Suzanne, easily and with premeditation, circumvented this by finding out when the woman in charge was on leave and arriving on that day to collect Charmaine. The child's refusals were ignored, and she was marched to Suzanne's waiting vehicle and whisked off before anyone could think about whether it was the right thing to do or not. Such was the charm and manipulation of Suzanne Fisser. What made it even stranger that this child was allowed to go with these people is how they were dressed when they collected her. Suzanne was wearing ski pants, three sizes too small for her, and a bikini top that barely covered her enormous breasts. Dirk was wearing Lycra cycling shorts and was naked from the waist up. They explained that they were going to gym. As soon as they drove away from the home, Suzanne handed a pair of ski pants to Charmaine, who was sitting in the back seat, and told her to put them on. She initially refused, but Suzanne said that she was going to embarrass them at the gym because no one wore normal clothes there, so she had better change. The "or else" to the already frightened child was implied. Charmaine did her best to change without exposing herself, as Suzanne refused to take her eyes off her, and she caught Dirk watching her in the rearview mirror while she changed. When they arrived at the gym, the couple went off to exercise and left Charmaine wandering around on her own. When the couple took her to their house after the gym, she was almost immediately thrown into the lion's den. Suzanne told Charmaine to come to the bedroom while she changed out of her gym clothes, and the porn collection and sex toys were again in full view. Please keep in mind that Charmaine is only 11 years old. She would later testify that Suzanne had stripped naked and used a vibrator on herself in front of her. She told Charmaine that it was her turn. The child refused, and instead, Suzanne had continued to masturbate while fondling the child, who was frozen in fear and begging her to stop. When Suzanne was finished, she told Charmaine to choose a porn video from the collection. The child said she couldn't even look at the movies and just reached out and grabbed one without looking and handed it to Suzanne. In the lounge, Charmaine was told to sit in one of the chairs while the couple played the porn movie, and then proceeded to reenact every single scene in front of the child. They then put Charmaine to bed. Dirk later came into her room and tried to kiss and touch her. The next day, Charmaine was forced to swim naked with Suzanne while Dirk watched, and then she was given clothing that she described as something sex workers would wear and instructed to put it on. She refused. Later that afternoon, Suzanne called Charmaine into the bathroom where she found Dirk naked in the bathtub. She was instructed to perform oral sex on Dirk in the way that she had seen Suzanne do it. The child was paralyzed with fear, and when they realized that they weren't going to get her to do it, she instead had to watch as Suzanne did. When they were finished, Dirk left and instructed Suzanne to shave Charmaine's legs. Although the ghoul protested because she knew she'd get into trouble at the children's home, Suzanne held her down and shaved her legs. When Charmaine was returned to the children's home on Sunday, she was sobbing inconsolably. But the couple had threatened her with violence if she said anything. So for a while, she kept quiet. Eventually, though, she couldn't take it any longer, and she told one of the house mothers about the horrendous weekend she'd endured. After Charmaine confessed about what she'd been through, Anya was called in and asked what her experience had been. She admitted that she'd had an equally disturbing weekend. Management at the children's home initially decided not to lay charges against Suzanne and Dirk because they didn't believe it would be in the interests of the children. Instead, they contacted other children's homes in the area and advised them not to allow the couple to take their children away for the weekend. The girls were given counselling to manage their trauma. Eventually, after the home received many reports of the couple attempting to get children from other homes, they realised they needed to do something. So they reported their incidents to the children's court. Sadly, we know how slowly the wheels of justice turn, and the couple would have more than enough opportunity to commit some of their worst crimes before anything actually came of the reports. The victim who would be perhaps most severely impacted by Suzanne and Dirk was a young girl we'll call Yolande. We have quite a lot of information about Yolande's life, and I think it's pertinent to tell some of her story. Yolande was one of four children born to alcohol and drug-addicted parents. She and her older sister were extremely close, and when Yolande was 9 years old, the sisters started begging on the streets for money for food. Their parents were also stealing to make money, and while they were out doing this, the children had to stay with their grandmother, who had recently remarried. It soon emerged that Yolande's step-grandfather had been sexually abusing her, She reported this to her mother and father, who simply told her to essentially grin and bear it, and refused to report the sexual assault to police. After this, the girls started running away from home. They preferred to sleep on the street rather than in the same house with the man who was assaulting them with their mother's consent. They'd been on the streets for a while when their parents divorced. Each parent was already in a new relationship, and the girls were essentially abandoned, as neither parent's new partner wanted them around. The girls met a woman called Sue, who would help them on and off and be their only stability in their lives for many years to come. Sue was a soft-hearted local woman who regularly helped local runaways, giving them food, trying to help them get off drugs, and sometimes having them stay in her house with her own children. The girl's mother had heard that her daughters were staying with this woman, and she decided she didn't like it. Anytime she heard that they were with Sue, she would go and fetch them. They would then run away, and the cycle would perpetuate. Sue tried to get official help for the girls too, through police and social services. She alleges that the SAPS told her that the girls, despite being minors, had been living on the fringes of society for too long for them to be able to do anything about the situation. Social services took a harder stance and told Sue to stop meddling and threatened her with legal action if she continued to try to find help for the girls, because she was not a registered social worker. By the time Yolandi was 11 years old, she was already drinking alcohol daily and smoking marijuana. She was occasionally placed in a children's home, but would run away, as she said it was worse than living on the streets. Yolandi wanted to live with Sue, who was happy to take her in, but her mother would hear nothing of it. She constantly complained to social workers or collected Yolandi from Sue's home. Eventually, Yolandi started using heroin and began living with 17 other street children in an illegally occupied derelict building in Pretoria. The SAPS was trying to have them removed, and Sue was trying to get the building declared a safe zone for the children. She could no longer have them at her own house, as she'd been threatened with eviction several times for having the down-on-their-luck crowd living with her. This fight eventually made the news, and one Suzanne Fisser contacted Sue to offer her services as an advocate to help the fight. Sue had no idea who Suzanne was, and wasn't familiar with the advocate Barbie persona either. She eagerly accepted the woman's help. It's unclear how much help Suzanne and Dirk were in the matter, but it did get them access to vulnerable children. Yolandi was trying her best to get her life back on track. She'd gone to rehab and managed to get off heroin, which is no easy feat. She was staying with Sue and had even gone back to school. Suzanne, though, had taken a liking to Yolandi, and it wasn't long before she was attempting to convince Yolandi's mother to let the child visit them for the weekend. Yolandi was more than willing to go, because she greatly admired Suzanne. But her mother had heard stories about the busty blonde and was not as eager. In typical parental grooming behaviour, Suzanne started in on earning Yolandi's mother's trust. She would be allowed to take the girl to a mall for a few hours at a time, and the report back from the child was always glowing. Eventually, Yolandi's mother relented and allowed her daughter to visit with Suzanne at her home on the weekend of her 14th birthday. The one condition was that she had to be back home in time to celebrate with her family on the Sunday. Suzanne agreed, and Yolandi was collected on Friday. That Friday night was quite normal, but on the Saturday, Dirk instructed Suzanne to make Yolandi a cup of Milo. The girl would later say that she did not remember very much after that cup of Milo. She did recall camera flashes going off, and had vague memories of being raped by both Dirk and Cezanne. Cezanne, of course, would later deny any involvement, saying that she'd gone to lock the doors and close the windows in the house, and when she'd returned, she'd found Dirk raping Yolande. When Yolande woke on Sunday morning, she was still extremely groggy, and Cezanne held her up while she administered a vaginal douche to the child, clearly attempting to remove any DNA evidence from her body. Although her mother had insisted that she be returned early on Sunday morning, the woman eventually found her child standing on her doorstep that afternoon. Yolande still looked totally out of it and was sobbing uncontrollably. Eventually, she admitted to her mother that she believed that the couple had drugged and raped her the previous day. With her mother's history of refusing to report such things to the police, and Yolande's own fear and mistrust of the police from when she lived on the street, it was a stroke of luck that a third party had overheard Yolande's admission that day and insisted the matter be reported. It would be Yolande who eventually stopped Cezanne and Dirk from continuing with their crimes. The case was given to Captain Carl Cornelius to investigate. One of his first stops was to the children's court to see if any other complaints had been made about the couple. Due to their own strange processes, the child advocates refused to share any other cases with Cornelius, and therefore he didn't know at the time about Charmaine or Anya's experiences. Thankfully, the captain didn't give up there, and eventually, through talking to enough people, including Dirk's previous secretaries, he managed to round up enough evidence to get a search warrant. Yolande, unfortunately, started to spiral out of control again after her rape at the hands of Dirk and Cezanne. She started using heroin again. Soon after the incident, Sue said that her heroin use became so bad that she felt like the girl was trying to purposefully overdose. She would start coming down from one high and inject herself again. Captain Cornelius executed a search warrant on Inner Circle Castle in December 2002. The search took 10 hours, and the police eventually left with two computers, several bags of pornography, and a photo album they'd found in Dirk's safe. The album, covered in red leather, would become a pivotal piece of evidence in the trial. It contained many photographs depicting child sexual abuse. Some of the girls that had been fostered by the pair for weekends were in the photographs. Right next to the album, in the safe, sat several tubs of prescription medication, which included Rohypnol. Captain Cornelius later said that Dirk had been a loudmouth throughout the search, shouting that he was going to sue the state and that he was being framed. When Cornelius asked him for a key to the safe, though, he suddenly became very quiet. He knew very well that the contents of that safe would be his undoing. Following the search, Cezanne and Dirk were arrested and taken to separate police stations for questioning. Within minutes of her interrogation starting, and before being told what she was there for, Cezanne admitted to Cornelius that she had helped Dirk to commit other crimes, and that she would give him all of the information she had. With that sentence, she admitted that she knew that what they'd been doing was wrong and illegal, and that they'd done more than one thing. In my opinion, that immediate turn on Dirk also says something else. Cezanne would later claim that she was under total and utter control of Dirk, and that it was like someone had replaced her brain with his. That extent of coercive control is not undone in 5 minutes. You don't go from being under complete control of someone to the extent that you're committing sex crimes against minors with him, to being willing to turn tail and tell all just because you're sitting in front of the police. If anything, in my opinion, that situation should have strengthened her resolve. But it didn't. I think that, at the very least, should give us some pause for thought. Suzanne tried to send a letter to Dirk, ending their relationship, but police intercepted it, and he never received it. By the next time she saw him in court, she had decided once again that they were in a relationship and that she was going to support him instead of turning against him. She would continue with this flip-flopping for several months. Suzanne and Dirk were given bail on the condition that they have no contact with each other or their victims or other witnesses. Dirk tried to fight against the no-contact order, claiming that it was unconstitutional to not allow a married couple to have access to each other. This is the extent of this man's narcissism. Despite the fact that the prosecution could have very easily proved that they were not married, he saw fit to present this lie in court, and his attorney went along with it. The order remained in force, though, and Suzanne had to go live with her mother. Dirk did not comply with the order, and he constantly tried to get in contact with her and arrived at Suzanne's house regularly. At this point, Suzanne had been convinced by her mother that she needed to end the relationship, which she did. Dirk didn't care, though. On Valentine's Day, he sent Suzanne a bunch of roses in a crystal vase. Her mother wanted to throw the flowers in the dustbin, and when Suzanne refused, they got into a huge fight, which ended with Suzanne smashing the vase on the floor. Suzanne called Dirk to collect her, and she moved back in with him, once again taking out a protection order against her mother. Dirk had moved back to his love-bombing phase with Suzanne, presumably attempting to guarantee that she didn't testify against him. The couple presented to the courts that she could not be forced to live with a person against whom she had a protection order, and she had nowhere else to go, so they had to relax the order of no contact between the couple. In reality, Suzanne had many places to go at this time. Her father, Laurie, and several other people had invited her to stay with them to get her away from Dirk, but she didn't want that. Dirk put Inner Circle Castle up for sale, and he purchased a farm in Bella Bella. Captain Cornelius was struggling to get enough evidence together for his case, as Dirk was hiring people to threaten witnesses. Yolande was difficult to work with. Cornelius applied to the court for additional time to start the trial, but that was denied, and the prosecution had to retract the charges against Dirk and Suzanne, with the caveat that they could be reinstated as soon as they had enough evidence to go to trial. In all, both Suzanne and Dirk had been facing 11 charges of sexual abuse each. Suzanne, in the meantime, had come to a stark realization that if she was going to be able to protect her daughter from Dirk, she would have to pretend to like him. It was the only way. She called the couple and asked to meet with him. She told them that she realized she had been wrong all along and that she wanted to support them through this difficult time. She sang Dirk's praises and eventually managed to convince them that she was on their side. I don't think she realized at the time how closely she was dancing with the devil, and the consequences that it would have for her with the charges against him having been dropped. For now, Dirk reverted back to his old self, turning Suzanne back into his sex object, and now that Suzanne was in their lives, she witnessed it firsthand. Dirk allowed Suzanne and Suzanne to go on holiday together to Cape Town. And when he picked them up at the airport, on their return, he showed both mother and daughter how much respect he had for either of them. When the woman got into the car, Suzanne in the front and Suzanne in the back, both realized that Dirk had his penis outside of his pants. Without greeting Suzanne, he pushed her face into his crotch, and she performed oral sex on him while her mother covered her own face with her jacket in the back seat, so that she didn't have to watch. She knew as well as Dirk did that if she protested, her daughter would be lost to her again. In 2003, the case was officially reopened, and they were both charged again with the same 11 offences. In 2005, they both pleaded not guilty and were again given bail. Neither had been seen as a flight risk, so if they needed to leave the country, they just needed to advise the court of their intention to do so. Dirk travelled to Russia once during this time and returned. And then, in November 2005, he advised the court that he planned to spend Christmas in Russia. The court agreed and postponed the trial to April 2006. The set date came and went, and there was no sign of Dirk Prinsloo. He'd fled the country and not returned. He was not in contact with anyone in South Africa, and even his attorney had no idea where he was. An international arrest warrant was issued, and he was placed on Interpol's list of wanted fugitives. It's unclear when Suzanne and Dirk's relationship actually came to an end, but by the time he left her holding the proverbial bag, it was most certainly over in Suzanne's eyes. She started the process of returning her physical appearance to normal. She had her breast implants removed and stopped applying peroxide to her hair. She swapped her contact lenses for glasses and cut her hair into a bob. Without Dirk allegedly controlling her eating, she also gained a bit of weight. By the time Dirk disappeared, Suzanne looked like any other normal woman on the street. Her advocate Barbie persona may have been gone, but she still had to face the music. And this time, she had to do it alone. Several years would pass as authorities attempted to locate Dirk Prinsloo, to no avail, and Suzanne was informed that if Dirk did not surface soon, she would have to go on trial on her own. In June 2009, Dirk Prinsloo was located. Well, technically, he was rearrested, but not in Russia, and not in South Africa either. In fact, his arrest had nothing to do with the crimes he was accused of in South Africa. Dirk Prinsloo was arrested in Belarus for bank robbery and a charge they referred to as thuggery. Dirk would claim that he'd only been caught because his girlfriend at the time had been stupid enough, in his words, to give the police his email address and password, and that's how they tracked him down. What actually happened is that Dirk left his passport in the bank he'd robbed, so police didn't really have to look very far to figure out who their perpetrator was. Dirk, of course, will never admit to this because it makes him look like the bumbling fool he is. In the 3 years that Dirk had first been in Russia and then in Belarus, he'd racked up a string of girlfriends. He'd even fathered a child with one of them. Many of the women described him as charming, but several women came forward with reports of domestic violence, and one even later accused him of attempted murder. An image of Dirk on trial in Belarus was splashed across South African media. In it, he was sitting in a cage in the middle of a courtroom. The cage is standard practice to house accused persons in Belarus, but it did feel very fitting. As soon as the news broke in South Africa that Dirk had been arrested, a South African journalist travelled over to Belarus to speak to him. She described him in an article as being overweight and unkempt, and he would later tell her that this had really hurt his feelings. It emerged that Dirk had been travelling under a fake name, and all of his girlfriends, even the one he'd had a child with, knew him as Michael Grant. He told everyone he was an Australian businessman. Apparently, no one was able to tell the difference between a South African accent and an Australian one, which doesn't really surprise me, as many foreigners mistake the two. Of the charges against him in Belarus, he told the journalist that he just seemed to have the habit of falling in love with the wrong women. Dirk was found guilty of many of the charges against him in Belarus and sentenced to serve 10 years in prison. He made no bid to be returned to South Africa. This sentence meant that South African authorities decided they would no longer hold off on Cezanne's trial and they would deal with Dirk separately when he was one day deported back to South Africa. Cezanne attempted to claim that she had experienced battered woman syndrome. And while she denied many of the claims against her, the one she could not deny, she instead blamed on being controlled by Dirk. Now, don't get me wrong, battered woman syndrome is a very real collection of symptoms related to sustained emotional, financial, and physical abuse, and may be and has been a fair enough defense in some cases, where there is sufficient evidence of such. In this case, I don't know so much. Sadly, in 2010, the same year that Cezanne was convicted of all the charges against her and sentenced to 7 years in prison, Yolandi took her own life. Cezanne attempted to appeal her sentence, but this was refused. She would eventually only serve 3 years before, in 2013, after two prior refused parole hearings, she was granted parole under certain conditions. Both Dirk and Cezanne's names were removed from the list of advocates, and Cezanne's name was placed on the sex offender register. She was also put under house arrest for the remainder of her sentence, with an allowance that she could go to work, but she had to return by a stipulated time and was not allowed to leave her house for any other reason unless she had permission to do so. In 2018, Cezanne married a businessman from KwaZulu-Natal. The year before that, Dirk had become eligible for parole in Belarus. When the South African government was advised of the possibility of this happening, they had to decide whether they would request for him to be extradited or wait for Belarus to deport him. The former meant that he would be accompanied by an Interpol official on a flight back to South Africa and then handed over to police on his arrival. Deportation, however, meant that he would be sent back on his own volition. And although Belarusian authorities would advise South Africa of his deportation flight details, no one would be accompanying him, and there would be no direct flights from Belarus to South Africa. The layovers would give him far too much scope for escape. Extradition seemed safer, but the cost would also have to be borne by South Africa, and it was expensive, while deportation costs would be borne by Belarus, but it was less secure. While South African authorities ummed and awed about what to do, the Belarusian authorities released Dirk and then rearrested him for deportation. And that is pretty much the last South Africa heard of Dirk Prinsloo. When I originally covered this case back in 2019, things were basically up in the air. But since I had to re-record this episode to ensure I had sufficiently anonymized the minor victims to comply with regulations that changed in 2022, I can now tell you a little more in 2026 than I could back in 2019. Just 6 months ago, Dirk Prinsloo surfaced again. Somehow, he's been living in Lithuania. There is very little information about how he came to be there or whether he's been there all this time. But Lithuanian authorities are now attempting to deport him back to South Africa. Although no one has said whether that is related to visa or citizenship contraventions or something else. South Africa is allegedly engaging with Lithuanian authorities, but there's no extradition treaty in place between the two countries, so there is a lot of red tape to get through. Dirk Prinsloo is fighting the possible deportation / extradition because he says that he will not get a fair trial in South Africa. Whether Dirk Prinsloo will ever face justice in South Africa for his crimes remains to be seen. Sadly, for at least one of his victims, it's too late. So I said in the beginning of this episode that I still had no idea whether I agreed with the side of the debate that says Cezanne was just another victim, or with the side of the debate that says she was a predator, just as Dirk is alleged to be. I think it may be a mixture of the two. There is no doubt that Cezanne experienced some level of control and abuse at Dirk's hands. There are external witnesses and evidence which confirm that. Question is, how much impact did that control and abuse really have on the crime she committed? I can't help but compare this case to the likes of Rosemary and Fred West in the UK, and our own infamous alleged predator couple, Joey Harthoff and Gert van Rooyen. In both those cases, the woman was seen to have been a pawn in the relationship, forced to take part in their male partner's crimes because they were abused or otherwise controlled. Also, in both of those cases, it was proven that the woman had equal, if not more, significant involvement in the more sadistic parts of the crimes, of their very own volition. I don't know that we can compare Cezanne to either one of those women, but it certainly is an interesting contrast. To our knowledge, Cezanne has gone on to live a completely normal life without committing any other crimes that we know of. As we've seen with other criminal couples, though, and even in the group murder scenario of the Krugersdorp killers, sometimes all it takes to wake up nefarious desires is someone meeting the right, or rather wrong, person. There seems to be something about the pairing of two very particular people that just brings out the worst underlying pathology in each. And unfortunately, in this case, that had ongoing consequences for many, many people. I do hope that Dirk Prinsloo will answer to the charges against him at some point. The victims in question deserve it. And I, for one, would sleep a lot easier knowing that he's not out there manipulating, controlling, and abusing anyone else. Updates on episode 21 as at April 2026. Because I ended up re-recording this episode before releasing it as a rewind episode, you already have heard some of the updates in the body of the original episode. But there are some more. Firstly, I wanted to address how interesting I found it that 6 years later, I decided to handle this case quite differently from how I originally did. While I did anonymize the victims originally because they were minors, I decided to remove a lot more of the information that I had shared about them because it could actually identify them. As you'll have heard, I included a lot of mentions of the fact that I changed the names of the victims, even the deceased victim, even though her real name has been in the public domain. And this is because I noticed after I initially released the episode in 2020 that some people who had known the victims were confused as to why their names had been changed, and some even said that they thought that this was disrespectful, obviously not understanding why I was doing it. The reason I gave the deceased victim a pseudonym as well is because I shared a bit about her life, which, although pertinent to the abuse she suffered in these crimes, probably wasn't something her family would want linked to her name forever. And it felt a bit salacious to include her real identity for really no reason. I also realized that I had initially included the actual identity of an alleged rape victim without even realizing I'd done that. That rape was never included on a charge list to Dirk, to my knowledge, but with what I know now, I also realized how deeply harmful that could be, even though the victim has actually spoken publicly about it. I also approached how I spoke about Cezanne differently. My views on her actions and crimes are still very much the same, but I think I've come to understand some nuances over the years when it comes to offenders. And as a result, I found that some information I'd shared about her that didn't actually relate to the crimes wasn't really relevant, so I removed it. There was also a point where I actually reconsidered republishing this episode at all. I wondered if I was just rehashing something that had been a big headline at one point, and I was thinking about all the emails I'd probably get from those close to the perpetrators or the perpetrators themselves, telling me how I was re-victimizing someone who had served their time. And yes, Suzanne Fisser has served her time, and I'll talk a bit more in the moments about what her life might look like now. But firstly, these victims still suffered greatly. And secondly, the second alleged perpetrator still has not been brought to trial for these crimes. And that is really what confirmed for me that I needed to republish this episode. As at April 2026, Dirk Prinsloo remains in Lithuania, fighting his forced return back to South Africa, claiming that he will not get a fair trial here. He is attempting to get refugee status in Lithuania. On the basis of these claims, I then also wondered whether pushing this back into the feed could actually be harmful to the case against him. Could he claim that coverage had prejudiced him? But really, as with any other case I cover that's not been fully entertained in the courts, I have only included information that is already in the public domain through court records or public interviews, and everything else is clearly stated as either the opinion of a particular witness or hearsay based on experiences by these individuals. All of this could and should be tested in court if it has not been already. None of what I've shared here changes the physical evidence of what was found in Dirk Prinsloo's home or the case the investigating officer has built. I would also hope that if it came to it, Suzanne would be willing to testify against Dirk, as that would truly be a test of her remorse, in my opinion. Of course, it would pull her right back into the public eye, but in my view at least, it would be the right thing to do. And on that topic, let's talk about Suzanne Fisser today. The last time she was mentioned publicly was in 2023, when Heiskanoot wrote an article following up on this case. In that article, the journalist detailed a conversation they'd had with Suzanne, as well as someone close to her and her husband. When the journalist first set out to write the article they had, naturally, they tried to make contact with Suzanne and initially struggled and assumed they'd have to write it without her input. But then they got a call from a withheld number, and when they answered, it was Suzanne, saying that she'd heard they were looking for her. The journalist recounts how Suzanne went on to explain that she's now happily married and living in Gauteng. She said she's done her best to build a successful life and really does not want to be pulled back into the spotlight. And that is completely understandable. But unfortunately for her, until Dirk stands in front of a judge and receives a judgment based on a fair trial and the preponderance of evidence, this will never be over. That's not to say she doesn't have the right to continue on with her life and make the best of it. Of course she does. And as far as we know, she seems to have been a model of rehabilitation. To our knowledge, there have been no further crimes, and she is now a businesswoman and contributes to society. Especially where a sex offender is concerned, this is perhaps the ideal outcome. I have no idea how the surviving victims feel about this case still hanging in limbo 2 decades later. But if they still want to see full justice, then we should absolutely support that in any way we can. And really, so should anyone who was involved in this series of crimes and has already been convicted and served their time. For me, true rehabilitation includes the acknowledgement of the harm caused to victims. And tacked onto that is the responsibility to do anything within your power to ensure you assist the victims to receive full and final closure. Until that happens, no one can truly move forward in every sense of the word. If I look at South Africa's track record of actually getting accused persons back to local soil for trial if they've escaped overseas, I'm honestly concerned that Dirk Prinsloo will never face the charges that remain here for him. In the grand scheme of the type of crimes that happen in this country on a daily basis, my concern is that these charges will not be seen as severe enough to warrant a large amount of money being spent in extradition and then in a trial. Don't get me wrong, I absolutely think it's worth it and should happen. But if I weigh up what I've seen happen and how I know some of these departments to work, I don't have a lot of hope for true justice here, just from a realistic perspective. It was interesting for me to notice how my views on female offenders were already developing in 2020, when I originally covered this case. In just a year of starting this podcast, I'd already started to question this idea that female offenders are all either these black widow constructs or somehow being led around by their nose by their criminal partners. Today, I understand this far more deeply than ever before. In fact, there might even be a future book about the topic. As a society, we need to approach these cases involving female offenders with an evidence-based view and stop the preconceptions. Female offenders are undoubtedly different to male offenders, but they are no less guilty. Simultaneously, I acknowledge that in some cases there are elements of coercive control or abuse present. But we see that with male offenders sometimes too. We have seen cases where a male offender has been manipulated and coerced into committing crimes by a female offender. And that can be acknowledged while also not condoning the crimes themselves. Elements like coercive control can be taken into account during sentencing, but it never makes you more or less guilty of a crime. Self-defense is a different matter here, and that's not what we're talking about. I found it incredibly interesting that when Heyskanoot wrote that article in 2023 about Cezanne and this case, there was a little insert on the page where they compared her actions to that of Nandipa Magudumana, a former medical doctor who's accused of assisting convicted murderer and rapist Thabo Bester to escape from prison and stay on the run. Magudumana herself has occasionally suggested that she may have been a victim of abuse or coercive control. But all of her actions in court to date have suggested a defense around her simply not being guilty because she says she didn't do what she's accused of doing. She also hasn't publicly shown any animosity toward Bester. I get the parallels, of course. Both Magudumana and Fissa were attractive, intelligent, professional women in well-respected professions who no one would have pegged to be criminals or involved with men like Bester and allegedly Prinsloo. But why are we trying so hard to find reasons for their crimes, while simultaneously instantly accepting that their male criminal partners must have committed the crimes they're attached to? I struggled with this for a long time, and I still do sometimes. I think the best explanation for it that I've heard from all the experts I've spoken to about this is that there is a very good chance that none of these parties would have been able to commit the crimes they did if they hadn't found themselves involved with that very specific other partner. They may have done something, sure, But both the male and the female offenders, or accused offenders, came into the situation with a very specific underlying pathology, which was just horribly, perfectly activated by that of the other. Of all of the rabbit holes I've gone down in this case, though, the one that still haunts me in 2026 is this. We know for the most part what Suzanne Fisser has been doing for the last two decades, where she's been and what her life has looked like. But we have absolutely no idea what Dirk has been doing. Yes, he was in prison in Belarus for a few years, but since then, and before that, he was just out there, living his life. From reports, it seems clear that many women have come forward to say that they've dated him while he was on the run. One even had a child with him. And if the allegations of pedophilic tendencies from Dirk are valid, we know individuals like that do not stop. If he was truly preying on 11-year-old girls in South Africa, he absolutely would not have ceased that behavior when he was no longer in the country. And sadly, every country, no matter how well-resourced, has a vulnerable part of their population with equally vulnerable children. And I think that is a pretty good reason for this episode to stay in circulation. Because until Dirk Prinsloo comes back to South Africa and proves his innocence, every single child and woman in the countries he lives in could be in danger. And really, that is a terrifying thought. For more victim-focused true crime content, please follow True Crime South Africa on the app you're using to listen right now. I also have another podcast you might like called I Lived Through This. Follow the podcasts on social media platforms for updates on new episodes and other crime-related stuff. If you'd like to support the podcast and grab some True Crime South Africa branded merch, listen up. CCSA has partnered with the SA Criminologist platform, and if you head over to their website now, you can stock up on a wide range of true crime-themed merch, including tumblers, stickers, pens, mugs, and so much more. And if you use the code TCSA at checkout, you'll get a site-wide discount of 10%. Check out the full range of true crime-themed merch at sacriminologist.co.za. And support TCSA while grabbing some truly cool goodies for you or your partner in crime. I'll be back with another episode before you know it. Until then, thank you so much for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.